I left my undergrad degree and I moved to Panama, to a very small island in the middle of the Panama Canal, where there were many tropical biologists studying everything above ground, these huge, chaotic tropical forests. But nobody was looking below our feet. And I started asking questions about what could give rise to such incredible ecosystems above ground. Through my work with SPUN, we work with people all around the world to understand these mycorrhizal networks in their own habitats. And I think the biggest challenge has really been for people to flip their perspectives and think about underground ecosystems as where life begins. It asks a really respectful question. What is it like to be you?
Welcome to CC, the podcast where you see what others see.
Hi there. Good morning. So today, what are we talking about? Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? Ceci here. Is anyone there? Hi, my name is Ceci. I'm based in Berlin, and I want to welcome you to CC, the podcast where you see what others see. This season is all about the mind. And today, we step into the hidden world beneath our feet. We'll explore the vast fungal networks that link plants and trees into a living web, where information flows, resources are traded, and strategic decisions emerge without a brain. And guess with whom we'll be talking?
Our guest today is evolutionary biologist Toby Kears, University Research Chair and Professor of Evolutionary Biology at the Vrije Universiteit Amsterdam, whose groundbreaking research draws on economic and evolutionary theory to understand how non-cognitive organisms, such as fungal networks, process information to strategically move resources as they trade with plants. As she graciously showcased in her TED Talk, titled Lesson from Fungi on Markets and Economics, Kears explains how, like us, mycorrhizal fungi that live in plant and tree roots engage in strategic trading, theft, and the withholding of resources, remarkably displaying a capacity to be opportunistic and sometimes even ruthless, and the challenges they faced due to inequality of resources. Toby Kears is co-founder of the Society for the Protection of Underground Networks, SPUN, where she serves as chief scientist and executive director. Through SPUN, she leads global efforts to map and protect the vast fungal networks that sustain ecosystems and store carbon in the earth, revealing the intricate biological economies beneath our feet that are essential for life on Earth. Her pioneering research has earned her many honors, including a MacArthur Genius Award, the Climate Breakthrough Award 2025, Spinoza Prize, Amodo Unfettered Science Award, E.O. Wilson Award for Natural History, and the Amsterdam Science Innovation Impact Award. She's also been featured in Time 100 Next, listed among the Explorers Club 50, and recognized as a Smithsonian Magazine Innovator to Watch. Through storytelling and scientific rigor, she invites us to explore the dynamic and complex subterranean world, where organisms have been evolving sophisticated trade strategies for hundreds of millions of years.
And to that wonderful introduction, one more line, because Professor Kears has just been named the 2026 Tyler Prize laureate, the John and Alice Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement, often described as the Oscars of the environmental world. Thank you so much for being here today, Professor Kears, a rock star scientist of the fungi scene. Welcome.
It's such an honor to be here.
We often look up at the stars to find wonder, yet hidden universes exist right here on Earth. the depths of the ocean, the shifting layers of the atmosphere, and the delicate shimmering web of mycorrhizal fungi, connecting roots and trees like galaxies beneath our feet. Professor Kears, when and what first drew you to explore and study these underground fungal networks?
Well, life is literally buzzing under our feet. I don't think that people realize that about 59% of all species on Earth live underground. And so I became interested when I was quite young, actually, around 19 years old, and I wanted to be a field biologist. And so I left my undergrad degree and I moved to Panama, to a very small island in the middle of the Panama Canal, where there were many tropical biologists studying everything above ground, these huge, chaotic tropical forests. But nobody was looking below our feet. And I started asking questions about what could give rise to such incredible ecosystems above ground.
So before we go any further, it's worth remembering something remarkable. Fungi are far older than plants, and without them, plants might never have made it onto land at all. In a sense, fungi are the original architects of life on Earth. Reflecting on this, one of our guests in this series, Dr. Evan Alexander, a former Harvard neurosurgeon whose profound near-death experience reshaped his understanding of consciousness, left the following question for you.
Hello. Greetings, I'm Dr. Evan Alexander, and I have a question for Professor Kears. Over half a billion years ago, the Cambrian explosion sparked an extraordinary burst of evolutionary innovation, during which most major animal groups first appeared, and life on Earth suddenly became far more diverse and complex. As an evolutionary biologist, what is your understanding of the underlying reason that caused that rapid evolutionary expansion?
It's a great question. I mean, evolutionary partnerships, they really underlie life on Earth. You know, organisms across the tree of life, they form these symbiotic partnerships for metabolism and protection and resources. And these partnerships involve what we call symbionts, and they allow hosts to live in habitats that they'd otherwise be excluded from, really get inaccessible nutrients and even capture very novel forms of energy. And so I think when we talk about rapid evolutionary expansion, we need to understand these partnerships and really understand when hosts evolve really extreme dependence on each other. And this can sort of change the whole trajectory of evolution. And so if we think about plants and mycorrhizal fungi, for example, we know that about 450 million years ago, the first partnership between plants in an aquatic environment living in water and the ancestors of mycorrhizae began to form partnerships. And that allowed plants to start colonizing land as the fungi started eating rock and transferring those resources to their algal partners. And in return, of course, the algae were photosynthesizing and taking carbon out of the environment and feeding it to their fungal partners. And that really gave rise to the ecosystems we live in today. And so really trying to understand the breakdown, the formation of symbiotic partnerships is definitely key to understanding rapid evolutionary expansion.
And when we talk about bioassemblies beneath our feet, the idea of networks naturally brings to mind the interconnectedness of relationships. And in ecology, evolution, and biodiversity, as you were mentioning, the concept that captures our attention is, of course, symbiosis. Up next, we will hear from one of the leading thinkers at the crossroads of literature, science, and technology, Professor Catherine Hales. She is Distinguished Research Professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, and James B. Duke Professor Emerita at Duke University. And she will introduce us to the concept of symbiosis and its role in evolutionary history.
This idea really builds upon the work of Lynn Margulis, very distinguished biologist, who really revolutionized the evolutionary picture of how dynamics work by arguing that the main driver of evolution is not natural selection, as Darwin suggested, but rather symbiosis. And she did some astonishing pioneering work in being able to prove that the emergence of eukaryotic cells, that is, cells that can use oxygen, in fact occurred through an act of endosymbiosis. When one prokaryotic species invaded another, didn't die completely, but rather became the mitochondria, the energy-producing part of a cell. And that was confirmed when it was discovered that the DNA of the mitochondria are different than the DNA of the nucleus. So they are two different species now living together as a single organism. And the word that Margolis uses to describe that is endosymbiosis.
Given your work on the relationships between plants, roots, and fungi, how do you define symbiosis, and how is it different from mutualism and cooperation?
Well, the really classic definition of symbiosis is just defined by two species living very intimately together. So, in effect, this could actually be negative, as in parasitism, where one partner is gaining resources from the other, or positive, as in mutualism, when both partners are really benefiting from the interaction. But symbiosis is really this idea of living intimately together. Now, of course, mutualistic partnerships, where both partners tend to benefit, they really underlie life on our planet. We know that evolution of life on Earth has been driven by these very small number of major evolutionary transitions, and those have been characterized, as we just heard, by endosymbiosis, where individuals that previously replicated independently, all of a sudden they cooperate to form a new, more complex life form. So we heard about archaea and eubacteria forming eukaryotic cells and multicellular organisms. And of course, our own mitochondria are a great example. You know, we don't think of them as other organisms living inside us. Instead, we think of them as our own organelles. It's the same thing with insects. They have endosymbiotic bacteria that are also sort of considered organelles. But what we need to think about, and again, this is not a question of, is it natural selection or symbiosis? There's both things operating, because not all cooperative partnerships are en route to this sort of transition to a major evolutionary shift. It actually requires very strict conditions. The partner interests of the two partners, they really need to be aligned, and the benefits of a more, what you'd call like integrated cooperation, has to lead to really intense mutual dependence. So again, if we look at something like plants and fungi, they have their own interests. And there are times when these interests are almost perfectly aligned, but there's also a tension, especially when there's, let's say, multiple partners interacting simultaneously, creating what we call a tragedy of the commons. So it's not that all symbioses lead to major evolutionary transitions. And of course, natural selection is just the process underlying what partners benefit under certain conditions.
Well, now let's hear a fascinating example of dolphins and humans working together, shared by inaugural endowed professor for nature and humanity at Stony Brook University and founder of the Safina Center, ecologist Dr. Carl Safina.
The dolphins and the humans have somehow figured out and learned together that the dolphins can find fish, push them near the shore, where the humans can throw the nets, but inevitably some fish only get injured in the nets and don't get caught, and the dolphins can easily catch the injured fish. In some cases, the fishermen will throw the dolphins some fish. And this is an interspecies cooperative thing, which obviously involves both of them really thinking at the exact same level about what's going on.
Professor Kears, you talk about cooperation and tensions happening. So if dolphins and humans can team up in a mutualistic cooperation, what about fungi and plants? What kind of relationship do they have?
Well, we really have to think about the driving force for entering in a mutualistic relationship, and that is that there should be some benefit. And it makes sense, actually. Outsourcing a capability to another partner is an incredible tactic, right? We can't specialize in everything. So it's nice. It's better sometimes to work with a partner that has a unique trait that is specialized in, let's say, accessing a new form of food or energy or protecting against certain pathogens. But we also need to think about when this can be dangerous. We once wrote a piece called Welcome to Symbiont Prison that explores this idea that there's this kind of unjust side sometimes in symbioses. And in some cases, one partner really remains in control. But I'd say that that tension actually creates novelty. It drives innovation. So you're always going to have this inherent tension in mutualisms, even as you do between the humans and the dolphins, with the dolphins actually wanting more fish than they get and the humans wanting more fish than they get. And you can kind of call it like a reciprocal exploitation. You're always evolving strategies to try to get a bit more resources. And in this way, I think cheating can be a real driver of innovation. And it's more common than people imagine. One of the systems that I worked with when I was doing my PhD was between legumes, so bean plants, in this case, soybean plants, and rhizobia. And rhizobia are a bacteria that fix nitrogen from the atmosphere. So they actually take the small amount of nitrogen that we have in our atmosphere, and they have a way of breaking this triple bond that's very hard to break. And they do this in the root systems, in these very specialized cells on the root systems of soybean plants. And so the rhizobia are feeding nitrogen that they make from the air. It's an incredible symbiosis to legumes. And in return, the legumes give them carbohydrates, sugars.
Was this not an article published in Nature? I have it with me right now.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, so this is my PhD work published in Nature in 2003. And we were interested in why rhizobia keep fixing that nitrogen. It's quite expensive for them to do that. It takes lots of energy to break that triple bond. And there's this big question in evolutionary theory that if you're a rhizobia on a root system that's colonized by many other different competitors of rhizobia, and you're all getting the same amount of sugars, why would you spend all your energy being just a good team player if it pays to defect and actually be a free rider while all the other rhizobia on the root system are fixing nitrogen? So we did this experiment where we actually forced the rhizobia to cheat. Now, that sounds like it would be hard, but what we did was we actually grew the rhizobia in an argon atmosphere. So rather than a nitrogen atmosphere, we grew them in another inert gas, which is just argon. And of course, the rhizobia and an individual nodule, they were not actually allowed to fix nitrogen. And so then we watched, could the legume detect when it was being cheated and what would happen? And so when we put them in this argon atmosphere, we realized through a whole series of sort of complicated experiments that the legume was actually suffocating those bacteria that failed to produce nitrogen. So somehow it could sense at the level of the individual nodule when it was getting cheated and responded by actually suffocating those bacteria. And I think that this is, it's an interesting idea, you know, this idea that this tension exists in partnerships, but really it allows for an exploration of all kinds of new strategies and traits. And it leads to many times a really beautiful evolutionary arms race.
What would you say is the most important trait or drive for an individual to enter into a mutualistic relationship? Would it be maybe the capacity to increase the reproductive success?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so when you're entering into a mutualistic relationship, it's about gaining more resources while paying less costs. And usually that has to do with being able to reproduce. You need those resources to reproduce. And obviously, there's a very strong drive for reproduction in evolutionary biology. And so that's something that we look at. And those resources can be all kinds of resources. It doesn't necessarily have to be food. It could be protection, or it could be space. It could be safe space. But what it leads to is really interesting partnerships that evolve basically everywhere we look.
It's striking how many parallels there are with the way we humans build up our own economies. I mean, it's the same logic of maximizing resources while minimizing costs, and the same instinct to secure space, protection, I don't know, the conditions to thrive. It's all there.
Yes, exactly.
Thinking about how nature is driven by reproductive success, well, in markets, it's driven by profit. That tension, that push to do better, seems connected to the way you compare biological exchanges with economic ones. Was there a moment in the field or in the lab when you realized these fungal networks were far more strategic than we thought? And could you give us perhaps a couple of simple examples of how different species interact in these networks and what they gain from each other? I mean, you've been already talking a little bit about that, but maybe another specific example?
Of course. So the relationship between plants and mycorrhizal fungi is a little bit different than the one I just explained about nitrogen-fixing bacteria. And why that is because these mycorrhizal networks, they form networks. And what that means is that they can interact with multiple partners simultaneously. So where you think of a bacteria almost being enslaved by the legume itself inside the nodule, when a plant interacts with mycorrhizal fungi, that fungi can simultaneously interact with other plant partners. And so this gives it a little bit more what we call trading power. And to understand this relationship, you need to first really understand the exchange of resources. So what a plant is doing is it's taking CO2 out of the atmosphere via photosynthesis, and it's turning that carbon into a form that it can feed directly to mycorrhizal fungi. Now, this carbon goes down to the root system, and then it enters into the network itself. And the mycorrhizal fungi we study, they are completely dependent on the plant for all of their carbon, right? They're not getting it from the environment. They're only getting fed from plants. So that creates a really like an obligate dependence on trade for these resources. They use the carbon to build these very complex networks underground. And in return, the fungi are foraging for other resources like phosphorus and nitrogen, which they then collect into the network and feed up into the plant root. Now, again, what's important about this particular relationship is that it's what we call a bipartite network. Like, that's a big word, but it basically only means that an individual plant can interact with multiple strains of fungi simultaneously. So it can choose which fungi to allocate its resources to. At the same time, an individual fungi can interact with multiple plants. And so what this does is that it means that both sides of the relationship, there's a choice about where to send those resources. And so we started looking at these plant fungal networks and asking, do they resemble sort of economic markets? And I guess that's where this research became really, really interesting.
Because there's so much complexity in these exchanges. And besides sugars and I believe also fats, you were also mentioning space and protection when it gets into roots, for example. What other worth mentioning resources are exchanged, let's say, between plants and fungi and roots in these networks? And which minerals are the most sought after in the underground markets?
Yeah, good question. So from the plant side of view, we know it's carbon. So they're sending carbon, but it's in different forms, again, of sugars and fats, which is an incredible diet to live on for the fungi. And for the fungi, this is still an open field of research, I would say. Most people at the initial, when we first started studying it, it was all about phosphorus. But then we realized that nitrogen was also moving through the networks and large amounts of nitrogen. Also, some minerals that are more scarce. And now we don't know if the fungi are actually going out and mining those in particular, or if they are coming into the network because of other forms of resources that are mainly dominated by phosphorus and nitrogen. We also know that water is incredibly important as a resource. These fungi can really help plants survive in extreme drought conditions. And so that's a really important benefit that they provide. But there's other benefits. Like we know that these plants that are colonized by mycorrhizal fungi, it also upregulates their defenses. Now, this is a really hard service to study because it's very diffuse. But what we know is that when the fungi actually colonize the root, that it changes the chemistry of the plant leaves and it protects them against certain both pathogens and herbivory. We also know that the fungi are very good at protecting plants from heavy metals, that they actually can prevent them from getting up into the plant leaves. Microplastics is another avenue that people are looking at, that the fungi can protect, again, the upper part of the plant from accumulating microplastics. So these are the kinds of things that people are just starting to explore, that it might not just be as clear as carbon for phosphorus.
This is amazing. And for all, it takes us to other ways of thinking about the importance of fungi for ecology and all the destruction that we've been making with plastic and metals and so on. And maybe we would begin to trade with them about some ideas on how to free ourselves of all of those materials. You were talking at the beginning about aligning interests in these relationships and talking about the exchanges and the ability to communicate. Let's let Professor Hales introduce us to the concept of Umwelt and the different aspects that this concept brings about.
And an important element here is the idea of the Umwelt, term from 19th century biologist Jakob von Uxkull. And Uxkull's idea was simple and brilliant, and that is that each species constructs its own world dependent on its neurological and physical capacities. So that has a number of interesting implications, one of which is that humans do not sense reality any more than all the other species do. We sense reality as interpreted through human sensibilities. So we're always within the human Umwelt, a word that means roughly world horizon or world surround. And there's no way that we can escape it because we always see with human eyes, we think with human brains. Now, we have enlarged our Umwelt through technologies like microscopes, telescopes, and so forth. But in the last analysis, all of that is always filtered through a human brain. So that's one of the implications of the Umwelt idea, and it's central to the idea of an integrated cognitive framework, because in order for two species to communicate, they have to have overlapping Umwelten. So we communicate with dogs, for example, because we know that they see the squirrel that we also see, and so we can communicate through words or signals or body language about it. If there's no overlap between the Umwelten, then communication is not possible, although we have found a lot of artificial ways to begin to create those overlaps, for example, with the fungal networks.
We were here before also Dr. Zefina speaking about the dolphins. That could also be referred as an Umwelt overlapping example, as he correctly pointed out on how communication between humans and dolphins when fishing together and cooperating happens exactly at the same level of awareness. I mean, just like the communications happening between plants and fungi. And you, Professor Kears, and your colleagues published a paper in Nature, and there was also a subsequent New York Times article about an incredible robot used in the lab to track fungal decision-making. Could you tell us a bit about this robot and maybe share other tools you use, sensor setups, anything that helps you trace how carbon, phosphorus, and other resources move between fungi and plants?
Yeah, this is definitely one of my favorite topics to talk about because it asks a really respectful question, I think. And that's the question, what is it like to be you? And we wanted to develop a way to ask that of these mycorrhizal networks. What is it like to be you? And so together with my colleague, Professor Tom Shimizu, who is a biophysicist at ELMOF, which is the Biophysics Research Institute here in Amsterdam, and a very talented postdoc, Loreto Oriete-Galvez, we spent years designing and building a custom-designed robot that really does this high throughput, we call time-lapsing, that could track over 500,000 fungal nodes across space and time in these living networks that were attached to roots. And so you can think of each one of those nodes as a decision point, where the fungi either go left, they go right, or they form a bridge and fuse together. And what we're trying to do is understand how they navigate space and then try to understand how they move resources to be able to achieve this very efficient road system that they build underground. And so you can imagine this robot is taking these time-lapse images, and we're tracking every node using very complicated pipelines to extract the structure of the network. But I think what makes it even more interesting is that at specific points in time and space, we could actually measure the flows inside the network. Now, these fungi are translucent, which is very lucky for us, and it allows us to measure these flow trajectories inside the network. So again, we measured about 100,000 of these cytoplasmic flow trajectories towards and away from root to really test how fungi optimized carbon movement and all of the sort of what we call supply chain design challenges that they face. And this work, it was really exciting because it showed us that the flow patterns inside these networks were really high dimensional. They contained a lot of information. The fungi were modulating the velocity, the direction, even the viscosity of their internal flows throughout the network. Now, this is sort of the first hint of trying to decode something in an organism that allows us to really understand how they're making decisions and how they're interacting the world, how they're processing information. So it feels like a really exciting time right now to be able to sort of peek into the inner lives of fungi. And together with some other techniques that we're developing, we can actually sort of track individual decision points.
Which you were able to measure the velocity of these flows?
Yeah, they're very fast. And I think people don't really understand how they work. This is the first time we saw them. The biophysicists at the Institute were flabbergasted. They just could not believe these kinds of dynamics were functioning inside the network. So you have to picture almost like a tube, an open tube, and imagine a river flowing through it. But instead of the river moving in one direction, which is usually how rivers flow, imagine having two currents moving in opposite directions at the same time. Now, this is wild. This is not usually how cells operate, but it's really important for these fungi because imagine what has to happen. The plants are taking carbon from the root system, and it has to get all the way down to the tip of the fungal network. Simultaneously, of course, the fungi are collecting these resources and moving it in the opposite direction. And so you can actually start to see these dynamics inside the network. And it's fascinating. I mean, once you see it and you see how exquisitely sensitive these networks are to small changes in their environment, you're basically hooked for life.
I can imagine. And how quick are they? Are they like 5 kilometers per hour or how do you know, or have you been able to witness that?
Yeah. The speeds are quite slow. We did one calculation because it's in a small tube and it's a microscopic organism. It's a slow, to our perspective, it's quite a slow movement. But we did a calculation that if you were inside the network, it would feel like you were moving about 40 kilometers an hour.
Wow.
So if you're a small particle inside the network, it feels like you're moving pretty fast. So it's actually fascinating to understand how they modulate these flows. It's really changed our perspective. And I think by being able to image them, it also shows the world just how alive the underground is and how important it is. I mean, we're starting to really think about these networks as an underground circulatory system. And that's because they really are responsible for so much carbon movement. We know that about 13 billion tons, it's a big number, 13 billion tons of carbon are processed by plants above ground and then fed to mycorrhizal networks every year. So that's equivalent to roughly a third of emissions from fossil fuels are being processed by plants and fed to these networks across the earth. And so it's quite interesting to understand, once that carbon gets into the network, how do the fungi move it, and where do they move it? And so we're developing some new techniques right now in the lab where we actually can tag the carbon with a fluorescent label. And so we can visually track both sort of the global resource distribution patterns, but also individual decision points where a small blob of carbon will actually come to a junction in the road, and we can watch which direction it goes or if it splits perfectly in half.
Fantastic. You know, I was picturing a metropole at night when you're watching the different cars going in different directions, and then you mentioned the neofluorescent light, and then I thought, that's Miami.
Yes. Yes, sometimes we show images of traffic jams in LA at Thanksgiving, with cars moving in both directions, you know, in these in these long lines. But what's different about these road systems is that there's a barrier, in our road systems that make sure that cars are going either north or south. But in these fungi, it's an open pipe tube. And so we really are still trying to understand how they control that.
Amazing. Well, the thing that I found fascinating about your approach is that you don't use the analogy of exchanges in fungal networks simply to draw parallels between their world and ours. I think you go much deeper using the analogy of these economic markets as a kind of cognitive, brilliant Umwelt translation tool that helps us understand behaviors happening underground in a way we humans can actually relate to. Is that right? Could we see the market theory framework as a cognitive tool?
Yeah, so I think where it's important to be very careful about language here. And this idea of market economies as an analogy to describe trade between plant roots and mycorrhizal fungi. And I just want to clarify that when people use the word analogy, that yes, definitely, it's a way of explaining the world about how organisms trade. But it can also be an analytical tool. So what economics does is it gives us a real mathematical framework to analyze trade strategies in a very predictive, quantitative manner. And this is a little bit different from just telling a story. And so I give an example of grooming markets between non-human primates. For example, this is work of Ronald Noe here, who's in the Netherlands, who started working with these primate groups and seeing that he could make predictions, like a certain amount of food was given for a certain amount of grooming for a service. But as that food availability goes up, the price goes down. So it was an analytical framework called biological market theory that just allowed us to start trying to make predictions about what we thought an organism would do under a certain context, under a certain amount of resources. And so I think we can play with these same principles with other organisms in nature, even those ones that don't have a central nervous system. There's no real need for a central nervous system like a brain to be able to calculate. It's instead that these strategies, they're going to be under strong selection from evolution. And so if you gave away, let's say, all of your carbon to any old fungal strain and you got nothing in return, it wouldn't last very long. And so over time, these strategies have evolved that really allow partners to be able to discriminate, I would say, about different trading partners. And that's really what we're trying to understand, is that can plants and fungi interact in a way where they're able to tell a good partner from a bad partner? So we can think about this as almost a science of discrimination, right? What we wanted to first do is to set up experiments to actually test if plants could discriminate from less effective and more effective fungal strains. And of course, this is key data, because it would suggest that there is some mechanism that allows partners to sense when they're getting a good deal or not. And what does it take to discriminate? What are the exact mechanisms? And that's really a fundamental requirement to be a successful organism, is the ability to sense the amount of resources. And so this is where we really started trying to set up experiments about discrimination and trying to understand how these organisms interact in a way that really allows them to maximize the amount of resources that they're able to get themselves.
I think this is brilliant. This is hardcore science. And I see why you won the MacArthur Genius Award.
Yes, that's just happened. It was quite a surprise. And it's really exciting because I think it was the first time that the MacArthur Foundation recognize someone studying fungi. And so sometimes it really does feel like this award in particular is really much more for the fungi than us. But it shows that if we have some patience and really study these trade dynamics with the tools that are emerging right now, that we can really uncover some very sophisticated strategies, I would say, that have evolved over time.
Absolutely. Let's go a bit deeper into these exchanges happening underneath our feet. Well, market theory, as you've been explaining, only works when a trader has multiple trade partners and fungal networks, as we just learned, are no exception. So since energy drives everything in both ecosystems and economies, there's, I think, an incredible complexity, as I'm understanding, happening in these exchanges processes. And if we think of carbon as the currency, in this underground market, in what ways can a change in carbon availability shift the balance of power between plants and fungi? Are these shifts dramatic?
Are the shifts dramatic? I mean, they are to us that, you know, when we set up these experiments in the lab, but I think it's a good question. I mean, changing resource availability constantly shifts balance of power. As does changing the number of partners in a relationship, right? If you're just in a monopoly, then that really changes the strategies that you can evolve rather than if you're interacting with numerous partners simultaneously. So we can look at theory and try to understand when trade is likely to be favored. And for example, we know that trade is favored when individuals interact with multiple partners of both species, and also when there's a greater, let's say, relative difference between species in their ability to acquire resources. So if there's a very small difference between species in their ability to get resources, then we don't expect trade to emerge. But if there is a bigger ability, that's when we start seeing these differences and trade really being driven. And so when you say, how does changing the amount of carbon, yes, something like that can really change and shift the power dynamics.
Are there parts of the network that work like hubs or exchange houses for trading? In other words, does trading happen at specific points, or is it more a diffuse process?
No, so trade in these networks between plants and mycorrhizal fungi happen at very specialized structures called arbuscules. Arbuscules, so these fungi are actually called arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. Arbuscules are beautiful structures that are formed and found inside plant roots. So you can imagine a mycorrhizal network is actually penetrating into a root cell. And then it forms this very intricate and delicate structure called an arbuscule that looks like a mini tree, actually, inside the network. And why it looks so convoluted, like a tree with branches, is that means it really has a high surface to volume ratio. So there's many places for trade to happen on that particular structure. And that's where the trade takes place. That's where the carbon is loaded into the fungal network. And that's where the phosphorus is exchanged from the fungal side. Now, there's a lot of work going on trying to understand the dynamics of these arbuscules because they're such powerhouses of where the interaction takes place. And still so much to learn. But one interesting thing that scientists have discovered in recent years is just how ephemeral they are. They can form and then they can collapse, typically within about 7 days. And that also leads to very interesting trade dynamics because it means that that one spot where that bartering is happening can only happen for a short time and then it disappears. And the fungus seems to colonize down the root system. And so once it's already traded with one root cell, it doesn't tend to reinfect. So it makes this wave of colonization as it moves down the growing root system where the trade is taking place.
This this really sounds like magic.
It is. When you're in the lab, it actually looks like magic as well.
And Professor Kears, could you share perhaps one experiment that you would run in the lab through which we could picture how you track these processes? You were naming already with this light and so, but maybe some specifics on how maybe you shift the balances of power in these exchanges.
Of course, these experiments are always hard to describe because there's so many things happening simultaneously. But first, you have to picture a Petri plate because this is essential. This is all of our work takes place in these very, very sterile lab conditions. And that's a whole nother conversation about what we're finding in the lab, whether it can be translated out into nature. But if you imagine a plate, we've got a root system on one side of that plate. So it looks kind of like a sort of a messy network of plant roots. We colonize that root system with the fungi, and then the fungi cross over this barrier into what we call the fungal arena, and that's where all the magic takes place. And this is an area where it's just the fungi growing, and then we can manipulate the fungi however we want, adding more resources or adding things that it doesn't like, things that it likes, mazes, all kinds of things. And one of the experiments that we did, this is something that was published in, I think, 2019, was we really wanted to understand how fungi themselves deal with being exposed to inequality, meaning if they're exposed to high differences in resource availability across a single network, how do they deal with that in terms of how they trade with the plant root? So in this case, we had an experiment in a triple plate compartment. So that means it was broken up into three parts. One part was the root system, and the other two parts were the fungal arenas. And we had developed this technique using quantum dots. So quantum dots are they're nanoparticles that are fluoresce in very bright, pure colors when exposed to a UV light source. And we attach those quantum dots to apatite, which is a form of phosphorus. And so you can just imagine we created phosphorus that was either blue or red. And then we put the phosphorus into the compartments at different concentrations. So the most interesting treatment, of course, was when one side of the network was exposed to lots of resources and the other was exposed to just the tiniest amount. So in this case, it was a difference of 90% of the resources went in one compartment and 10% in the other. Now, because these resources were different colors, we could see what the fungi then did with the movement of these phosphorus resources. What we found, which was stunning to even us, was that the fungi, they responded to this resource inequality by actually moving the phosphorus from the rich compartment to the poor compartment, where they then traded with the plant root. Okay, so why would they do that, right? They actively move the resources from the rich patches to the poor patches. And we think that they did this to really capitalize on demand differences. So the root system that was growing on the poor side of the network was willing to pay more phosphorus. So the demand on that side of the network was higher. So what it looks like is that the fungi are actually moving the phosphorus to a place where they're able to get more carbon per unit phosphorus. So the fungus gains more by moving the phosphorus within the networks to areas of higher demand, really places where the host was willing to pay more.
Incredible. And how long does an experiment like this typically take, and what kind of budget does it usually require?
Yeah, these are achingly precise experiments. So I think the setup of the experiment is what takes so long. There's so many pilot projects to make sure that the right amount of nutrients and that all of the controls are taken care of, that there's no toxicity involved, that there's no difference, let's say, in the size of the quantum dots, if one is red and one is blue. If that also, there's lots and lots of, I guess I would say, separate control experiments that go on to make sure that we're actually testing what we think we're testing. So an experiment like that, to actually pull it off, I think it was about 2 years. from start to finish. Building the robot, for example, as a multi-year project, 3 or 4 years to develop that one. But the experiments themselves, where we're just growing the fungi and everything is in place and there are enough replicates, those usually last between 2 and 3 weeks. Sometimes we grow the fungi up to about 6 weeks, but a lot of the dynamics happen within the first couple of weeks after they cross into the fungal arena. But the fungi are very slow growing compared to some molds that you would imagine, let's say, in your kitchen. These are very slow growing networks. And so first you have to make sure that the root is fully colonized, that they're colonized to the same amount, that the fungi are evenly crossing into the fungal compartment. So you start with about, 100 replicates. And by the time everything has to be accounted for, then you get about 15 replicates that you can really start tracking these dynamics in.
Well, speaking of technology, let's hear from the extraordinary British choreographer Alexander Whitley, founder of the company that bears his name. In his pioneer work, he explores the tension and evolving relationship between human bodies and technological systems. Here, he shares how technology can disrupt the natural flow of movement in dance. Let's listen.
Technology does generally break that flow. It introduces elements that work at different paces. They have different rhythms. And there's a lot of work that goes into developing the technology to the point where it is functional enough to get somewhere close to a flow state in creativity. It can be very frustrating because I, as a dancer and choreographer, and the dancers I work with, are all too aware and knowledgeable of what that flow state can be when it works, and just the speed at which ideas can emerge and be developed through interpersonal communication. And bringing technology into the mix slows that down and can be frustrating.
Hearing Alexander Whitley describe how technological interventions alter the natural flow, shifting patterns and dynamics, made me think of the fungal networks and what you mentioned about experiments happening in the lab and then being able to translate them to what it's actually happening in the field. And it prompted me to ask, when you're working in the lab, to that what extent do you think your interventions might alter the natural flow of exchanges within these fungal networks?
So that's a big question that we have. In terms of technology in the lab and getting into a flow state, I think one of the things that our technologies have allowed us to do is actually observe fungi in their flow state, literally. And that's because of technology. We wouldn't be able to do that with our very sort of coarse and blunt tools that we need to use in real ecosystems. Here in the lab, we can build these technologies and machines that allow us to observe fungi almost untouched. And that's really exciting for us because, again, if we're asking the question, what is it like to be you? We want to be able to observe without disturbing. And really, the technologies in the lab, that's what their aim is to do. And so you can imagine we have these big, dark rooms. I mean, everything has to be in the dark when you're taking some of these and growing these networks. And we try to make it as realistic to soil systems as possible. Of course, that's never possible. But the technologies, in our sense, allow us to really capture what would almost be impossible in natural ecosystems.
And if you wanted to observe those same processes at the scale of a real habitat, say an entire forest, do you think that's realistically achievable with today's technology and resources, or still beyond our reach because of cost and technical limitations?
Yes, this is a great question and one that we think about all the time in our lab. We, again, very highly controlled conditions in the lab make it possible to track 500,000 decision points on a fungal network in space and time. As soon as you go out into nature, everything changes. All bets are off. You can think about ecosystems really outside the lab. They're just like an opera of interactions. And translating what we find into field conditions, I think, is really the next big frontier. It's really hard to do. And In some cases, I think it's about resources and really a will. I mean, even if just a fraction of the resources that would go, let's say, into studying space would go into studying what's underground, then I think we could develop the tools to be able to track resources in natural environments. But right now, it's totally out of reach. So we spend a lot of time trying to advocate for more funding and more research to go into studying these in situ situations in real soil ecosystems, because that's where all bets are off, where we're really interested as well. How exactly does it work?
You know, I think it's important what you mentioned about exploring the outer space. And that reminded me of Merlin Sheldrake's Entangled Life, his book, which I'm about to finish, where he mentions that if you teased apart the mycelium in just a teaspoon of soil, it could stretch 4 kilometers. And globally, the total length of the mycorrhizal fungal mycelium in the top 10 sensors of soil is more than, and I put it in my notes, 450 quadrillion kilometers, which is over half of the width of the galaxy. So in a way, it's also like exploring the outer space, but just beneath our feet.
Yeah, exactly. So we're working right now on trying to update those numbers based on what we're seeing with our robotic imaging and based on more data coming in of people going out and actually sampling soils across the Earth and trying to understand the density of these networks. And the number, which we hope to publish sometime soon, is really enormous. And it's fascinating. And again, what it does is it's not so much about the number itself, but it's about trying to give shape, trying to give a sense to this underground circulatory system, right? And all of these fungal communities that are down there that are so responsible for our carbon cycle, our nutrient cycle, our water cycle, trying to understand that infrastructure because that's been so hidden. And again, I think these tools can help us understand what's happening there.
Absolutely. And going back to the arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi, these tree-like structures that form inside the plant root cells and appear and disappear and where trading happens and decision-making happens. Let's hear ecologist Carl Safina again, this time on his idea of intelligence in the living world and his example of how problem-solving can happen even without a brain or nervous system. We'll follow that with Catherine Hale's perspective on how cognition is built and the distinction she makes between cognitive systems, which she calls actors, and physical processes, which she calls agents. Let's listen.
My idea of intelligence is the ability to find a new solution to a new problem. So that has to do with creativity. You know, you've never seen this problem before, but you can think of something to do to solve the problem. Whether an animal can figure out a way of solving a new situation or confronting a new problem, and how good they are at that, and how many things they can solve, I think that that shows a range of intelligence. Experiments with slime molds. They are very mind-blowing because it is a single cell. They're pretty big, hundreds of nuclei, whoever heard of that. And yeah, they figure stuff out and they can remember it. So that challenges almost everything that we think about intelligence. We usually think that you can't be intelligent without a nervous system. Well, they only have one cell and it's not a neuron, but there are things going on in that cell that are very like what happens with a nervous system. But how is it happening? There's a lot of mysteries with slime molds, and I think they give us a lot of humility when we think we understand something about brains or minds, and then we're confronted with a single cell that can solve a problem in the most efficient way possible. You know, that's really amazing.
Cognition is built on physical and chemical processes. That's the foundation from which all higher capabilities emerge. But I distinguish between cognitive systems, which have the ability to perform interpretations and make selections or choices, and purely physical chemical processes. So I call cognitive agents actors, and physical chemical processes agents. So I'm distinguishing between actors and agents. So an example of a process that has agency would be a tornado. But a tornado is incapable of performing interpretations or making selections. It doesn't choose where it goes. It's just the resultant of all the physical forces acting upon it. Whereas all living organisms have the capability to make selections and perform interpretations. So all living organisms are actors. Physical, chemical, or material processes in themselves are agents.
So it seems that cognition can exist without a brain. And from what Professor Hales explained, all living things have these agent-level processes built into them. And on that note, the one and only Catherine Hales has actually left a question for you, Professor Kears.
So my question is this. Given your expertise in fungal networks, do you consider fungi to have cognitive capabilities? And I should just note that I define cognition as a process of interpreting information in contexts that connect it with meaning. So perhaps through calcium ion channels, but I leave this for you to consider. Thank you.
Well, fungi are actors. They're living beings and they have evolved strategies. But those strategies are based on agent processes like chemical and physical changes in the environment. I think we tend to be limited in our definition of intelligence. I mean, and in so many ways, right? Because we tend to recognize intelligence only for what we see in ourselves. And so it's quite hard for us to know what is a good decision for a mycorrhizal fungi. What we do know, and this is really important, is that these are strategies that have been shaped by natural selection for hundreds of millions of years in some of the most complex habitats on Earth, right? I mean, scientists say that soils are the most complex habitat on all of Earth. And so when we think about fungi, they live their lives just bathed in rich fields of sensory information. And I think it's our job to try to understand how they process that information across their bodies, how they use that information to determine where and when and how to move resources efficiently. So again, yeah, we think of fungi as being able to process information. And so when they do these, when they perform strategies and when we're able to capture that data, it's fascinating because what they're doing is quite complex. I mean, if we really take a step back, like they're collecting and trading nutrients, which means they have to be integrating, you know, very complex data streams across billions of growing tips, which at any minute could be connected between several different plants. So we have to realize that they're not just open conduits where these nutrients flow, but really that they're controlling carbon and nutrient flow with, I guess I would say, surprising precision. And that's really allowing them to resolve some of these most complicated supply chain trade-offs.
Absolutely. And I think when we talk about these strategies, I think about intention behind the strategies, because at the end, there's this driving force to reproduce and to survive, right?
Of course. I mean, that built into our own DNA is the ability to reproduce and survive. That helps us define what a living organism is. And that's what's exciting about the work that we're doing right now, is answering that exact question. And again, I like to use the term, you know, information processing, and trying to really dig in to understand how that works. And one of the experiments that we're doing right now is to really understand all of the different mechanisms by which these fungi may be processing information. And one of those is to look at the actual, you know, electrical activity in these networks. Living organisms, of course, rely on all kinds of electrical activity, voltage changes in ion channels to be able to sense their environment. And we're working with a really talented postdoc right now that's actually able to build these micropipettes that are just a, you know, half a micron, micron across, using almost artistry to be able to blow a glass to such a degree, pull this glass tip that it's incredibly tiny, and then puncture an individual hyphae in these complex networks. So it's like the skill of a surgeon using a really small micromanipulator to actually puncture the hyphae with a single pipette tip. And this allows us to study voltage changes, like actually understand electrical activity. So this is a whole new field that we're getting into right now that allows us to actually introduce a stimuli to a network and then see how that information may be moving across the network by measuring voltage changes. So stay tuned, because there's a lot of work and it'll probably take several years to do it correctly. But we really want to take the time to understand what are the underlying mechanisms. One of the big questions we have right now is whether decisions in fungal networks are dominated by what we call local rules or global rules. So is there just something happening very locally that allows, you know, tens of thousands of tips to coordinate together to make a decision? Or are there really global rules where it really is a coordination of billions of fungal tips, and that the fungus is acting like a calculator in many ways? So there's lots of competing hypotheses about how this can work. But it's really, I think, going to challenge our understanding of cognition and challenge our understanding of information processing in organisms that don't have a central nervous system.
How exciting. And for all what we've learned about these arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi.
Arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi.
Yeah, exactly. That they appear and disappear.
Exactly.
It's going to be difficult, but how exciting. To close this segment, we'll hear one final brilliant distinction from Professor Hale's on consciousness and cognition, and whether she herself believes fungi possess any cognitive capabilities.
The uncoupling of consciousness with cognition is a crucial move. That is really the point of the Unthought book. To argue that consciousness is not the whole of cognition, it's only a small part of cognition, even in humans. And in non-human organisms, the fact that they are not conscious, for example, trees are not conscious, fungi are not conscious, bacteria are not conscious, does not mean that they do not have cognitive capabilities. In fact, they do.
Hi, we would love to hear your comments and learn about what you see. Share your input at www.ccpodcast.com and follow us on social media. Oh, I almost forgot. To accompany us in this season's journey, don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And now let's continue with CC.
What do you see as the three most important strategies fungi and plants use to keep these markets going?
I can't believe you're going to make me name three. I mean,
we'll go to other kind of dynamics where we'll have a lot of room to talk about them.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, what three? I think I would choose the idea that the fungi avoid trading with plants that are growing in the shade, for example, in many cases in experiments. That they trade differently depending on how many fungal competitors are present, that they can artificially inflate the price of the phosphorus by hoarding it in their networks. I think those are a few of the strategies that are, you know, all of them require more investigation. Again, I wish so many more labs were working on this so that we could all compare notes. But I think that what we're discovering is that they do these strategies, and then a lot of times we're trying to understand what is the selection pressure that leads to it, and is it constantly happening? And I think one really important point when we talk about strategies is this idea that every strategy in and of itself is not going to be a perfect trade deal. Instead, evolution works on averages. So if we were to take the average of all of these different, you know, billions of trade strategies that are happening in space and time, on average, both partners would be trying to maximize their carbon or their phosphorus intake. But that doesn't mean that every single trade decision is a perfect decision. And that's really important for sort of understanding what we're seeing in the lab, because many people will point to it and say, well, no, there's obviously times when this happens or when this happens. Of course, that's the beauty of nature. And what we're really trying to understand is the larger patterns. And that's where you see some of these most sophisticated trade strategies emerge.
And Professor Kears, you were talking before about these host-imposed control mechanisms in legume rhizobia symbiosis, where poor partners were punished to the extent to be suffocated. And I want to ask you, are generous partners rewarded?
Generous partners tend to be rewarded. So those that give more resources tend to get more resources in return. But it's interesting. Again, there's this tension and there's this arm race. So let's take an example. A very cooperative mutualist might actually be able to gain a benefit from actively restricting the other partner's ability to obtain resources directly. So this is very interesting. So if you can imagine a root system that can take up nutrients directly, a really interesting strategy from a fungal point of view is to create a dependence, to actually force that root system to have a dependence on the fungi rather than being able to take it up directly. And so there's, for example, some hints in the literature that fungi are actually able to down-regulate a plant's own ability to get nutrients so that it does actually form more of an addiction on the plant on the fungi. So it hampers the ability of this partner to survive or reproduce without the help of the fungi. So I think in all of these cases, you know, yes, a generous partner is rewarded, but then we also have to just look a little bit harder. And there's also sort of very clever, innovative strategies that change that dynamic. We look in nature and there are plants that don't photosynthesize at all. You know, they're called ghost pipes. Many different kinds of orchids, for example, have evolved these strategies where they don't waste energy on photosynthesizing. They're white, and yet they're still plants. What they do is they actually tap into a fungal network and they steal the carbon rather than photosynthesizing themselves. So in this case, they're a parasite not only on the fungi themselves, but onto a green plant nearby that is photosynthesizing and putting that carbon into the network. Nature is like that. I just think that it's such a beautiful, again, opera of interactions. And it really demands that we take time to look at all of these different strategies and not just categorize them as generous or mutualistic, but really try to dig a bit deeper and understand the tensions that drive innovative strategies within those partnerships.
We like to add a bit of a play to the program with a quick game of short questions and short answers. And I have a few economic human scenarios, and I'd love for you to translate them into what's happening underground. If any of them would require a long, complicated explanation, just feel free to say pass. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
So in human economies, credit relies on trust. The idea that value can be exchanged now with something returned later. Do we see any version of that underground? For example, do fungi ever extend credit to plants in the sense of giving nutrients before they receive carbon in return?
Yes, there is definitely evidence that the fungi are the first to transfer nutrients to a plant, and it may not receive the full payoff until the burst of that arbuscule. So there is a time delay, but it's usually pretty short.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the next one. Debt and default. What happens when that balance breaks down? Are there cases where plants or fungi fail to pay back? Would you be mentioning already some of that? What they owe, and where one partner, for example, take advantage of the other, creating something like ecological debt?
I'm not sure about ecological debt, but cheaters, definitely cheaters. I mean, ghost pipes, as I said, are a perfect example of that.
And these cheaters, when they're caught, how do sanctions look in the underground?
Sanctions are intense. I mean, that's what I spent a lot of my first half of my career studying, was the evolution of sanctions and punishment in nature. It can be swift, it can be severe, and it can be clever. And so, yes, some forms it takes of aborting partners, other case suffocating. Sanctions are very varied and they're very intense.
In markets above ground, scarcity drives up prices and abundance lowers them. You've shown similar patterns in fungal trade. When phosphorus becomes rare, fungi demand more carbon. Could we think of that as a kind of biological interest rate or even inflation, and what that might teach us about how systems, both natural and human, stabilize themselves under stress?
Well, I'm not sure it's an interest rate per se. I think inflation is more likely. I think that's a notion as old as life itself, that the more something is scarce and important, the more that resource is worth. But I would say, yeah, nothing is stable. It's just a constant opera of back and forth.
The secrets stay behind, and we don't ever want to show them. Trees never close their eyes.
Mm-hmm. Now let's go to macroeconomics and speculation. Human markets are often driven by speculation, investing energy now in the hope of greater return later. Do fungi ever behave like that? For instance, do they invest nutrients in a plant that looks promising, as we've heard in the credit, even before it can fully repay them?
Ooh, it's a hard one. Again, because of the time scale of these experiments, it's hard to know. I think in the lab, we don't really see long-term planning. Also, from an evolutionary vantage point, it's hard to imagine. But we are exploring the concept of memory in fungi, and that's still to be determined. That's about all I can say for now.
In today's gig economy, we see flexible but often precarious exchanges, short-term collaborations without long-term security. Do you see echoes of that underground? Are there fungi or plants that act like freelancers, forming quick partnerships and moving on when a better offer appears?
Ooh, yes. Again, hard to test in the lab, but definitely happening in nature. I mean, we see that fungi adopt and adapt to all different types of strategy, similar to what plants do. Let's say after they first colonize a field, after a disturbance, there are some plants that get in there right away. They're called ruderal plants, and they're very good at colonizing fast. It's the same thing with fungi. Some fungi are very good at getting in, colonizing fast. There's a real priority order, we think, to the way that fungi colonize roots. And again, there's a lot to learn in nature. And in the lab, we can just set up very simple experiments to test that idea.
Well, the global economy depends on vast trade routes, shipping, exchange, and sometimes exploitation. The mycorrhizal networks also connect distant partners across systems. Would you say they operate more like fur trade cooperatives or like empires where certain fungi dominate the flow of resources?
Yeah, we definitely liken them more to local bartering rather than a vast global trade that we see as humans. I mean, it's still unknown exactly how large individual networks can grow to. It's really hard to study that in nature. But what we do know is that they're really operating locally. So I would say more like fair trade cooperatives, very local bartering systems.
Nevertheless, it seemed to be many examples of inequalities emerging underground, if I might say that.
Of course.
And my question is, are there fungal species that monopolize resources to exploit weaker partners? And if yes, what do you think that teaches about human economies?
I think all fungi would love to monopolize. that would be an ideal strategy in many ways, but life is far too fluid. It's far too ever-changing. And so even just a slight change in the environment changes which fungi has an upper hand. I'm not sure what that says about human economies. Again, it's always hard to draw parallels. But yes, I can definitely say that fungi do like to monopolize, but they don't last very long. There's always a new partner that's coming in to offer something different.
And I'm curious, you mentioned before seeing powerful decisions in fungi networks happen. But my question is, have you seen them before scarcity shows up like almost like anticipating it, or do these shifts only occur in response to scarcity? In other words, do fungi ever relocate resources preemptively, or are their decisions always driven by local shortages?
I think it's always by local context, but I don't think it's always by local shortages. So it could be local context, like a new space opens up or a pathogen enters. It doesn't always have to be about resources or scarcity, but the decisions that are made, at least that's our hypothesis for now, tend to be based on local context rather than preemptive planning.
Bionic and the Wires is an incredible band based in Manchester, formed by John Ross and Andy Kidd. John is a multidisciplinary artist, technologist, and environmental thinker, and the founder and CEO of Sow the City, a nonprofit environmental organization whose work challenges human-centric views of creativity. He's the visionary behind the band's groundbreaking setups, while Andy is the sonic sorcerer who brings the sound of raw bio signals brought to life through synthesizers, keyboards, and digital soundscapes. Together, they explore the intelligence and responsiveness of the natural world through bioelectrical signals that are translated into artistic expressions like the melody we're now hearing in the background, a mushroom in the wild playing the keyboard. And here is John Ross with a couple of questions for you.
Hi, my name is John Ross, and I'm from Bionic and the Wires. We're Manchester, UK-based bioartists that connect bionic arms to fungi so they can make music. Millions of people have watched our videos online, and the question that a lot of our viewers ask us is whether fungi can hear the music we're helping them create. Do you think that's possible? And what frequencies do you think they would respond to or even enjoy?
So mycorrhizal fungi are, we know that they're exquisitely sensitive to their environment. And when we think about, can fungi hear music, what we're talking about is actually vibration. And we do think that at least the fungi underground that we study are very sensitive to vibrations. And again, this is something that we're working on right now, is really trying to understand how vibrations affect the flow patterns inside these networks. Soils are complex. I cannot say it again. It is incredible what they are exposed to, really, really bathing in all kinds of different frequencies of vibrations. And so that is something that we're exploring in the lab. And it's something that you have to do very, very, very precisely. Because we can actually look at the flows in real time, we can expose them to different frequencies and see how those flow patterns change. And so in many ways, this is sometimes I liken to what we do to actually being a little bit like primatologists, just observing primates in nature. So we can set up all kinds of treatments like different vibrations and then see how they respond. And so that's something that we are actively working on right now.
Talking about emotions and feelings, let's listen to ecologist Carl Safina one last time on what he believes to be the most basic feeling in living things, followed by his answer to the question you formulated for him.
If you could imagine the first kind of creature that might have felt anything at all. So try to imagine something like a worm on the seabed in some ancient sea a billion years ago. And it might be the first thing that can feel anything at all. What does it need to feel? probably needs to feel if it has just bumped into some food. So if it bumps into mud or stones, the most basic feeling would be no. And if it bumps into food, the most basic feeling would be yeah. That is an aesthetic judgment. It's positive versus negative. It's good versus bad. And so it would prefer what seems good and feels good, right? So I actually think that detecting something and perceiving it as good, which is very much adjacent to beautiful and makes you want to be near it in the same kind of way, I think that is the most basic feeling in living things. Some people insist that every cell can feel, and some people insist that nothing without a brain can feel. Do fungi feel? That's her question. I don't know. The short answer is no one knows, and there's no consensus about it. But I will say this. These questions are not simple yes or no questions about one thing called feeling. I think that to try to get at this, you have to chop the stages into little bits. And one stage is processing information. So first of all, every cell is incredibly complex. It's not just a little bag of fluid with a nucleus in it and some DNA. It's an incredibly complex place with thousands and thousands of chemical reactions going on all the time. The membrane of every cell has numerous sensing ports that react to chemicals around it. And in that way, it senses the environment. I'm not saying it feels the environment, but it senses. If you think of like a motion sensor or a thermostat, they sense and respond. Basic cognition, which is unconscious cognition, senses, evaluates, and responds. All of this might be chemical reactions with no feeling. But every cell is capable of sensing, evaluating, and responding because that's how they can maintain themselves as alive without just falling apart in the world of entropy and randomness. So the question is, at what stage do they feel that? But fungus are very, very complicated and they clearly communicate. But a lot of things that are not conscious communicate. Our computers communicate, but that doesn't mean it's conscious. So I think it's clear that fungi are extremely complex. It's clear that they communicate a lot. I don't know if they're conscious. I would love to know what she thinks about that question.
So Professor Toby Kears, what do you say?
Wow. It's quite hard. I mean, using the word consciousness is difficult, I think. And that's why I always try to take it back to what we can see and what we can measure, because the jury's out and I'm open to finding new things. I think that's really important in science, is that it's not, doesn't become dogmatic. We have nothing to prove in terms of understanding if fungi are conscious or not. We just want to explore their inner lives. And so that's my job, is to sort of work together with these this incredible biophysics lab to probe the inner lives of fungi and come up with clever experiments that allow us to probe that world in a very respectful way and follow it very precisely. Again, I come back to these flow patterns inside the fungi. High dimensional information, so much information inside that network that we can start to capture of individual particles moving through it. Trying to make sense of that is very hard. I mean, obviously, we use a lot with machine learning algorithms to try to process what we're seeing, but we don't even know if we're asking the right questions. That's the kind of, you know, we're getting terabytes of data a month. This is a really big new field of trying to ask questions almost in a bottom up, not doing experiments where you set it up and that you sort of know the hypothesis of what you're testing ahead of time, but really probing an inner life is a different kind of scientific method that we're all just starting to explore. What I can say is that when people come into the lab and they interact with the fungi, which they can do in real time, I think that surprises people. I mean, we can actually go to the lab. We can tag the carbon with this fluorescent, beautiful label. We can take off the petri plate and we can just blow on the fungi. We can talk to the fungi and our breath changes the direction of the flows inside it. We can interact with the fungi on our time scale and sort of probe it in ways that we can see in real time. And when people do that, that changes the way that they see fungi, I think. And, you know, the fact that they're much closely related to animals than they are to plants is quite interesting. There's just a lot right on the edges of discovery. I think the next kind of 10 to 20 years, we're going to really use science and use different methods of questioning the world to figure out a lot more about fungi and maybe about even our own consciousness.
Absolutely. To close this segment, we'll hear one final brilliant distinction from Professor Hale's on consciousness, cognition, and whether she believes fungi possesses any cognitive capabilities.
The uncoupling of consciousness with cognition is a crucial move. That is really the point of the Unthought book, to argue that consciousness is not the whole of cognition. It's only a small part of cognition, even in humans. And in non-human organisms, the fact that they are not conscious, for example, trees are not conscious, fungi are not conscious, bacteria are not conscious, does not mean that they do not have cognitive capabilities. In fact, they do.
All I know is that beneath our forest, there's no central command center, no brain pulling the strings. Yet, we've learned through all that you have shared with us today that this remarkable fungal networks link roots, move nutrients, and distribute carbon and nitrogen across the soil. We also know that animals like ants and bears contribute minerals and nutrients that enter these underground systems. And we also learn how the fungi protect plants from plastic and from metals. In such a decentralized setup, we've talked about how competitive these fungal networks are, thriving for reproduction and survival. But I ask myself, if we think about ancestral evolutionary knowledge, could we see these fungal networks as a kind of equalizer distributing resources across the system? And could they be thought as a sort of collective memory, a living archive of the past that shape how resources move today?
We work with cultures and local communities all over the world. Through my work with SPUN, which stands for the Society for the Protection of Underground Networks, we are developing this new sort of way of doing science in a very decentralized way, where we work with people all around the world to understand fungal networks, these mycorrhizal networks in their own habitats. And I had the opportunity to travel to Ecuador to work with the Sariaku people together with a moth project. So moth stands for More Than Human Life project coming out of NYU Law. And we were able to talk to members of the Sariaku community about fungi and about what happens underground and actually show them videos of what it looks like with the carbon label traveling through the network. And I'll always remember, you know, some of the responses. Oh, well, of course this is happening. We knew this. This is part of our belief. This is part of our understanding of the living forest. And bringing in that different type of knowledge system, I think, is really critical. And that's what's happening right now is, you know, scientists are being more open to different knowledge systems, different ways of seeing the world. And I think it's really important. I mean, science is inherently creative and getting out there and understanding different ways of looking at the world is essential to understanding these systems. So again, it's not something that I can say yes or no to. It's only that I can say I'm open to different interpretations.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned SPUN, which is an organization that not only protects fungal networks, but also maps them, connects people around the world, as you said, and brings this underground universe into global awareness. Because for our very last question, we're going to travel to Panama. a place where I know opened the door for you into this magical world. After a long day in the fields, we are closing with a nice dinner on a nice garden. In front of us, there's a gorgeous lemon tree. We get lost in our thoughts, and suddenly the words of a beautiful, unpretentious poem by Jennifer Clement seem to drift into our minds.
Lemon Tree. If you climb a lemon tree, fell its bark with your feet and knees, smell its white flowers, rub in your hands its leaves. Remember, the tree is older than you, and in its branches you might find stories.
For our listeners, we were mentioning Spun, and in fact our guest Toby Kears created an atlas of mycorrhizal networks that ended up being published in Nature and in a subsequent article in the New York Times. Toby, if someone had told you in those early days in Panama that you'd one day will create the first atlas of the underground, will you have believed it?
it's so wonderful and how dramatic you say it. I also want to stress that this is just the beginning. Like, we were able to publish what we call the Underground Atlas, and it was a major achievement, but it's still just beginning. I mean, it's like 0.001% of the pixels on Earth have been sampled from mycorrhizal fungi. There's so much to do that the book is not closed on that chapter. But it is important to talk about. I mean, I think even a decade ago, sort of creating a blueprint of the Earth's living underground fungal communities would have seemed impossible. And when I was in Panama, I think really like our tools and our understandings, they generally have been confined to the Earth's surface and not so much about what's happening below ground. And with these emerging techniques, including machine learning and fungal sequencing and robotics, that we can start to work with fungi to change the trajectory of, I think, some of the biodiversity and climate crises. And that's what Spun is about. It's about bringing together a network of people around the world to actually go out and sample fungi in some of the most remote, hard to access ecosystems on Earth and bring those invisible networks to life, show who is where, and really start to kind of chart an atlas so we can protect these very, very important fungal communities below ground.
Well, you've come a long, long way. Today in the morning, I've just read that the protection of fungal networks is going to be included in the UK's environmental policy.
This is huge news. This is really an exciting day for Fungi Foundation and for Giuliana Forci, who's been leading this work. Incredible, incredible changes are happening, I think, both at national and international level for the protections of fungi. And a lot of the work that she's been doing with Fungi Foundation has made this possible. So we're all celebrating.
You know, hearing about all of this, you make me think also of how the Earth is a living, interconnected organism and that life exists not only above ground in forests and oceans, but it's also in the microscopic worlds that sustain them. And I think this is awesome. And my last question is, Toby, when you imagine the future of Spun, what do you see?
Well, we want to do norm shifting. I mean, I think people assume that soils are dead and inert, and that's because soil life is largely invisible. But we started using the term underground astronaut to describe our work because we want people to understand that this is as vast a frontier as above their heads. And I think the biggest challenge has really been for people to flip their perspectives and think about underground ecosystems as where life begins. So this future, if we're serious about protecting biodiversity, that means biodiversity below ground. It must include life underground. So that's what the future looks like. It's about making people curious. It's about imagining fungal networks and exploring their inner lives and behavior. And really, the future is about making people see the underground differently.
The secrets stay behind, and we don't ever want to show them. Trees never close their eyes. Everything they see burns their life away.
Well, Professor Toby Kears, I think that the kind of consciousness you create is that of an astronaut who travels thousands of kilometers to discover new universes, only to realize that everything and everyone is connected and that we are responsible of those connections as we become aware of them. Thank you for contributing to planetary science and helping us see the unseen systems that support all life, including, of course, our own. Your creative energy in discovering is both joyful and essential to awakening our society. Thank you so much for giving us your time today and for an amazing interview.
It's been such a pleasure to be on this journey with you. And go funky.
Thank you to all our listeners, wherever you are, for allowing us to spend time with you. If you would like to find out more about the exciting research by Professor Kears' lab, including papers and upcoming projects, please visit her website at www.tobykears.com for more information about SPUN, which is dedicated to mapping and protecting the Earth's underground fungal networks. Go to spun.earth. For social media, go to SPUN Underground and spun.youth. And last but not least, for all references, including papers published by Professor Toby Kears' lab in Nature, and for more information discussed during this interview, check out this episode's description. Thank you. Bye-bye.